Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Aaron and Trishul discuss insurance companies. How do these firms determine their premiums? How much should you pay? And when might it be appropriate to self-insure? Aaron and Trishul dig into left tail risk and the law of large numbers when comparing car insurance to life and long-term care insurance. If something is likely to happen eventually, you can assume that the insurance company is going to charge you enough to cover for that event. Insurance policies fall on a spectrum, with some good no-brainers on one end and with some borderline sketchy sales tactics on the other end. But many are in that gray area, where it depends on your individual preferences and circumstances. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hi, Aaron. Great to be here today, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Great to be here as well. Last time, we brought up the idea of insurance was actually like options as a hedge and how it can have a negative expected value. And one of the things that we wanted to use to expand on that was the idea of insurance. This is something that does have a negative expected value, but it actually becomes more important. And so we're going to try and go into a little depth about just how the math of insurance works so that you can understand why you need some insurance policies, which ones are more important than others, and when theoretically could you self-insure with my finger air quotes that you can't see because this is a podcast. So when could you self-insure? So Trishul, do you have any kind of quick additions to those topics that we're going to get to today?
I think that's a good introduction, Aaron. The things that I want to think about are the notion that, for example, last week we talked about how insurance can be helpful, maybe for protecting a portfolio, but now we're talking about an individual. So I think it'd be pretty neat to dig into how that might impact our clients and how they might think about insurance, because there's many different types, as we all know, and each one probably has its own nuances that's probably worth digging into.
Great. We'll make sure to address that. So the idea with insurance is you are paying a little bit to protect against some catastrophic event. And this is where the investments and the individual actually have that in common. That if you were using an option strategy or some other kind of hedging strategy, that you are going to reduce your returns than if you just held the investment alone by itself. You're going to have some kind of drag based on premiums you're paying, but you can protect against a huge catastrophic event. The way that applies to individuals is if you think about, I'll use car insurance and life insurance as the first examples, that ideally you pay those premiums for car insurance and life insurance and you never use them. That's the ideal scenario for every individual's life, that you've paid all this money out of pocket and it never gets used. Because that means that you never had that catastrophic event. You never had the accident that totaled your car and someone else's car that your insurance had to pay for, that your auto insurance had to pay for, and or you never passed away or had an untimely death that life insurance had to pay out for. And the idea that we were looking at here is the cost of those premiums worth it? If the ideal scenario is you pay all this money and never use it, could you have just saved up that amount of money so that if that catastrophic scenario happens, you have the money set aside? And if that ideal scenario does happen, where you never get in the car accidents, then you have this pile of money that you've saved up for other uses. And here's where is it important to understand the kind of levels of catastrophe. Theoretically, with car insurance, you could do that. If you're just thinking about the cost of the car, if your auto insurance costs you $1,000 a year, like that, depending on how many drivers, how many families. But if your auto insurance costs you $1,000 a year and the cost of your car is $30,000, then you might be able to save a little more aggressively and build up a cash reserve that's designed to be that reserve aspect. The main issue with auto insurance is the liability aspect, where now it's what happens if you cause an accident where someone else gets injured, and now it's not the $30,000 for the cost of your own car, it's the $500,000 of medical bills for the other individual. And this is where it starts to get similar to life insurance. So with life insurance at the very basic level, you are making these premiums every year. And we'll start with a 20-year term policy as the example. This is a relatively inexpensive, depending on your age, form of insurance where if you die in the next 20 years, they pay out the death benefit to your family or to your beneficiaries to make sure that they're taken care of. And if you don't die in 20 years, then the policy just goes away. Technically, you could renew it depending on the insurance company, but it becomes so expensive after 20 years and that 21st year that no one ever actually does it. And when you're looking at the costs of this insurance policy, the costs never add up to that death benefit. There's never actually, if it's $1 million policy, you never put $1 million into that policy. You might be paying on the scale of a few hundred dollars per year, depending on your age. So even if you paid $1,000 per year, which is you're probably in your 40s or 50s for $1 million life insurance policy. That might be a little high. If you're younger, you can probably get on the scale of $200 to $500 per year. But if you were paying that $1,000 per year for 20 years for $1 million life insurance, that's only $20,000. So there was no real scenario that you could self-insure. The way that the insurance company does that is they actually have enough people in their pool, enough insurance policy holders, that they can apply the law of large numbers, which says that the probability of you dying in those 20 years, while it's relatively low, in fact, it's on the scale of less than 1%, it's minuscule depending on your age. Your age is a huge factor, and there's other factors as well. They know that if they get enough people in their pool, say they get a few thousand people in their pool, now they can actually calculate with pretty high certainty how many people in that pool will die in those next 20 years. And the idea here is, while there's a very small chance that you will die in 20 years, if you have 1,000 people and you know of all 30-year-olds, there's a 1% chance that the 30-year-old will die in the next 20 years. So they get 1,000 people. They can actually pretty accurately measure, okay, we're going to have 10 people die in the next 20 years. They can do that pretty accurately. And so now they just need enough premiums from all 1,000 people to know they're going to pay out for 10 of them. And that's how they can get that leverage aspect of they only need to collect $20,000 per person to build up enough reserves for them to pay out for those 10 people who did die. And the other 990 people who didn't, they will have paid in but never collected out. And it's that pooling effect that allows insurance companies to take on that risk. And they collect a small profit for operations and for just being a business and running this. But life insurance specifically has gotten pretty competitive across different insurance companies that the profit margins are relatively small. This is, we kind of joked, it's closer to the vig at the end that casinos charge, where they're really not trying to win big bets. They're trying to collect as many people as they can and collect a very small profit margin on each one. So at a high level of just the understanding that that pooling effect and the law of large numbers, Trishul, does that idea of life insurance make sense, that you can transfer that risk from the individual to the pool, knowing it'll be distributed correctly?
It does. So what I quickly did on a napkin in front of me is I just jotted down some figures based upon what you had just said. And it does make sense from that perspective. Basically, if I'm going to pay $20,000 over the next 20 years for $1 million and I have a 1% chance of dying, what that means for the insurance company is basically 1 million times 1% is around 10 grand. So as long as the insurance company pays out or collects more than 10 grand, in this case, 20 grand, then the insurance company makes, you know, some money, and they cover their risk, and I pay 20 grand for the case of getting some security of $1 million in case something bad happens over the next 20 years. So from that perspective, it makes sense. And I agree with you that the market has, for these types of simple products, come down in terms of overhead because there's a lot of efficiencies and these products themselves aren't that complex. So it does make sense. And there are times, for example, when you're young, where if something bad were to happen to you and you happen to be the breadwinner, that having that safety net is important. So having a term policy for when you're young seems like a sensible thing to do, especially if the premiums aren't that big of a deal and you do have these expectations of disruption that might happen should something bad happen. So overall, yeah, I think that makes sense. I also wanted to touch upon what you mentioned on the auto insurance side, just as another side example. And you had mentioned the notion that you have two types of coverages that you might look for. One is for liability, meaning what you might have to pay for other people in case something very bad happens. And that seems to be the bigger issue. And the second is your personal asset, your car. And that's normally known as comprehensive coverage or collision coverage. Mm-hmm. And that's a separate issue that can be priced into policies. So I guess my question to you is, for yourself, do you have liability and comprehensive with collision, or do you prefer to have one over the other?
That is a good question. We have done both in the past, and at this point, we have comprehensive coverage because we don't want to have to use our cash reserves to cover our car. I feel like our incomes are sufficient to cover those costs. And even though it does have a negative expected value, I don't want to have to maintain enough cash just for the car itself. And there are other uses for our cash and our assets that I keep in mind. It's going to be both emergency to cover the house and other living expenses as an emergency reserve, but also for opportunities. We're using it to kind of cover household expenses while I build up the business, but also we would probably look to buy rental property, going back to our conversation a while ago. So in the past, we had liability only, but as our incomes have grown, we have preferred to have the collision coverage because of the, I guess I almost like conveniences, but the additional benefits it provides and flexibility it provides, that we're taking care of that reserve from income rather than from assets. What about you?
It's interesting. I think I've taken the opposite approach for this particular case, where I may have had comprehensive and collision in the past, but I no longer have that for my vehicles. And it may have been a long time ago since we've had that. Early on, the cars were newer, and to cover their left tail event risk of something bad happening, it would have been a lot harder to cover. But at some point, what I started to do is I started to take that difference that I was paying for comprehensive and collision, and I put it in a side bucket of my own in my own account.
Okay.
And I let that grow at the market rate. And after 10 or 20 years, I actually had enough in there to cover the whole price of the car.
Okay.
So I've done that for all these various types of places where I might need to cover a bad situation, including home or extra warranties and things like that. So instead of getting those extra warranties or getting a ton of coverage for my home and personal assets, I've taken that money I would have spent on those insurance products, and I've put that into my own investment accounts and had them grow. And the notion is, I think I'm at the point now, if something bad happens, I can, as you said at the beginning of this podcast, self-insure, meaning I can just pull it out from that. And the pretty neat thing is, again, if either of my cars were to completely get totaled, I would still be ahead of the pack. And this amount that I have locked away and growing for these specific concerns is just going to continue to grow at the market rate over my lifetime. So it'll just get easier and easier to handle these worst case scenarios should they happen to come up.
You know, that's a good point that you made. I think that we had liability only before we got the cars that could hold our three kids. I think that was when we switched over. Now that you point that out, it was my wife and I each drive SUVs that could fit three car seats, and that when we got those cars, that's when we switched to including collision.
Yeah, I can see that. I guess the other thing that helped is I had paid off the cars pretty quickly. I didn't have to necessarily make a payment to a company for a loan on a car that didn't exist. So that certainly helped as well. Part of it is we actually did buy the cars a couple years used, so that automatically cut off a third of the price if they were new. So, you know, even that savings, that third, would go into this notion of, okay, now if the car is totaled, I have this third that I would have spent that I didn't, that can also help cover issues that might come down the road.
Okay. One thing you mentioned was that left tail risk, and that does get back to the kind of math of, it's not a normal distribution of, at the individual level, it's not a, here's how your average time you're going to crash per year kind of thing, because it's doesn't happen for so much of the time until it does, and the cost jumps up dramatically. And so I was wondering, could you explain what you mean by the left tail risk a little bit more?
Sure. Right. So as far as different events that may happen, some of them end up being very minor, such as you get a little ding and you have a flat tire. All of these things are completely normal and you might expect them year over year. But there are certain cases that have a low probability of occurrence, but a high probability of pain should those occurrences happen. And that's what I mean by left tail risk. So in those cases, you have something that may have a very small chance of happening, say 1% or 2%, but should they occur, they can cause you a lot of trouble. And those are the cases where insurance products make the most sense. Now, it's interesting with a car, because pretty much you have a depreciating asset with the car, meaning over time, it's going to kind of drop to zero in terms of its worth. So that's something to keep in mind. And also with a car, it just so happens that over your lifetime, you're almost guaranteed to get into an accident. The probabilities are just there. If you're driving a million miles over your lifetime, the chances of an accident over a million miles are close to one. So it's just one of those scenarios where it's probably going to happen, so you may want to anticipate it anyway. And the way I think about that is when it comes to the actual deductible, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So as an insurance product, you get to decide how much pain are you willing to take before the insurance kicks in. And one thing about the deductible is if you have a very high deductible, meaning I'm going to wait, pay the first $5,000 or $10,000, and then the insurance will kick in, your premiums will be a lot lower versus the insurance kicking in after you only have to put out $50.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what I found is the difference between those two can be pretty substantial. In fact, I did some quick math by, you know, just getting a quick quote this morning from a standard auto insurance company. And it turned out that if you wanted to have a low deductible, you would end up paying extra in premium over 3 years to cover that initial deductible that you would have. Meaning if you plan on getting in an accident in less than 3 years, then yeah, it's worth having that deductible being pretty low. But if you think on average you're going to have less than one accident every 3 years, then any time after 3 years without an accident, that extra money is money that is just going into the insurance company's pocket.
Yeah. So there's two things I want to elaborate there. One, that left tail risk, this is a good way for mathematicians to think about what I was trying to explain earlier. That left tail risk, especially on life insurance, exists at the individual level. It's really, really low probability until it becomes catastrophic. But when you pool enough people together and you apply that law of large numbers, that's actually when you start to see more of a normal distribution. That's what the insurance company can start to plan around. That 1% chance of dying becomes pretty consistent across a large pool. And they start to see, okay, we know 10 people are going to die with a standard deviation of, say, 2. And so there's a 95% chance that we're going to have between 6 and 14 people die over the life of this particular pool. And the actuaries, going through actuarial mathematics, they're pretty impressive, and they can start to apply this across a lot of different classes. So that's why with life insurance, you actually do have to go through underwriting to show that you don't have a terminal illness, and they can actually calculate your odds of dying over a certain time frame pretty accurately. This is where, for me, it's like the best anti-smoking ad is life insurance for smokers costs so much more because you really are that much more likely to die in the next 20 or 30 years if you're a smoker. It's almost astounding that two people, same age, same health, same height, weight, same habits, if one's a smoker and one's not, the smoker is likely to die. They've priced this in. It's pretty consistent about how effective insurance companies do. And this is one of those things where I tend to trust market effects pretty well, that insurance is really competitive, and there's a lot of companies out there trying to give you the best policy at the lowest premium, and they all price in that tobacco effect and price it up, and no one's willing to give you that big of a discount if you're a smoker. So the other thing was your auto insurance, the idea that if you drive 1,000,000 miles, the odds of a crash go up to 1. And this is where the math of self-insurance starts becoming a relevant conversation. That if you assume you're going to crash at some point, do you want the insurance company to pay for it, or can you build up enough reserves for yourself? Because if you assume that you're going to crash at some point, then the auto insurance company knows this. They know statistics on drivers and accidents much more effectively than any individual does. And they're going to charge you accordingly. They're going to charge you enough that it's no longer the life insurance example of we're going to charge you $20,000 and pay out $1,000,000. It's we're going to charge you $25,000 over 10 years, expecting we're going to pay out $20,000. Like that's how they make their profit, is it's, and over enough people and enough time, that'll keep repeating. They're going to likely charge you more in premiums than they will pay out. So this is where that negative expected value really becomes real. And it's a similar conversation with long-term care insurance. When long-term care first came out, the policies were relatively affordable, that you could kind of cover a husband and wife in their 70s, maybe 75, cover them for a few years in a long-term care stay, and the cost would be on the scale of $4,000 to $10,000. And considering long-term care facilities might cost $60,000 to $100,000 per year, these policies made a lot of sense. And so they were kind of used by people fairly effectively. But what happened was, over the span of about 5 to 10 years, insurance companies kind of realized that they were mispricing some of their policies. There were a couple things that came into play. One was that they built in assumptions of how many policies would lapse, because they've seen this across every other line of insurance. If you have a term insurance policy that goes 20 years, a lot of people end up paying 18 years and say, you know what, I've built up enough other reserves, I don't need this coverage anymore, I don't, my dependents are out of the house, I'll just stop paying it. And they let that policy, that policy lapse. Same thing happens across other auto insurance where, okay, they have changed, something in life has changed, they don't need that liability. They might get a new policy, but that they had priced it to go for a certain time frame, and they let that policy lapse. Same thing with disability insurance. As life changes, they might get a new policy somewhere else, but they were able to plan on a certain percentage of people letting policies go before their completion. This wasn't happening with long-term care. No one was letting their long-term care policies lapse. The other thing was basically long-term care and other healthcare costs were more expensive than they had originally anticipated. That once they started having to pay out for people in their 80s, that they'd been collecting premiums for 10 plus years, they realized that, no, these were mispriced, and they actually had to get permission from state insurance commissioners to raise premiums across all policies. And the reason this is a big deal is that insurance policy is a contract. Everything is detailed out. It's a big, thick document. Every part of that is detailed out. And part of that, we can't raise premiums without your permission, or we can't decrease benefits without your permission. If you think about it with a life insurance policy, this makes sense. That if you've been paying in, the company can't just decide not to pay out. So the fact that they were seeing this issue, they were able to go to these state insurance commissioners saying, if we don't raise premiums across everyone, this is the key. They weren't discriminating against any individual or any class. They're saying, no, everyone who has long-term care, we need to increase our premiums. Because if we don't increase premiums across everyone, we have the risk of running out of business. And if we go out of business, if we go bankrupt, then no one can collect on the policies. So insurance commissioners gave them permission to raise premiums for existing policyholders. And for a few years prior to that, they had been raising premiums for new policyholders, that they didn't issue any contracts that were at their lowest prices. And the prices got high enough that it started to look like the car insurance example. It was no longer a case of the life insurance example where, okay, you have a low probability of dying, but if you do, it's catastrophic. That analogy would be, it's unlikely you'll be in a long-term care facility, but if you do, we'll cover that catastrophe. It is now more like the car example where, if we have a couple, the odds of one of that pair spending at least a year in a long-term care facility starts to get over 50%. Where now, it's not the covering that left tail risk, it's just prepaying the cost. That the odds of, if you have enough people and enough couples and they live long enough, the odds of needing long-term care start to get closer to one like the car insurance. Except now, instead of the cost of the car being $40,000 to $50,000 with inflation, the cost of long-term care is $200,000 to $500,000, depending on where they're staying and how long they'll be there. So this is where they're now starting to charge $15,000 to $20,000 per year for a couple to have a long-term care policy. And now it starts to make sense. Should we take that $20,000 and just save it for 10 years? And now we've saved up $200,000. And if we need a long-term care stay, then we have that money. And if we don't, then we can use that for our lifestyle, or we can leave that to our heirs. But long-term care started off following the math of life insurance. And within about 10 years, they moved to the math similar to car insurance. And this is now where it's worth having that conversation of, do you choose to not buy the insurance policy and instead save up the amount that you would have spent on those premiums and self-insure? Air quotes again.
Right. I think the important distinction is insurance products are not investment products, nor are they savings vehicles. Those can be done outside of an insurance wrapper. And insurance is for, again, situations that likely have a low probability of occurring, but a high probability of paying should those low probability events happen. Mm-hmm. And if you're anticipating an event that pretty much is guaranteed to happen, like you're going to need care when you're older, or you're going to eventually die of some age, old age, then it may not make sense to use an insurance product as a saving vehicle for that almost guaranteed to happen event.
Correct. That's actually a really good way to interpret that. There are a couple other things I do want to bring up. So these are kind of other lines of insurance. And I'll try and get back. I hope this doesn't take a too convoluted, rambling way to get to answering that. But insurance companies also created annuities. And this was the flip side of the insurance, where the low probability event is that you die too soon. Once you get into old age, the low probability event is not you dying soon. Well, if you say you're over 70, the low probability event is actually you living past 100 and living longer. And so they created annuities where you take a lump sum of dollars and turn it into a lifetime income stream. And now the idea is they're going to pay out for their large pool, because if you happen to live past 100, you'll definitely have collected more from your monthly payments than you paid in, but they can use the law of large numbers and actuarial mathematics to know half of the people are going to die before this age, half people are going to live longer. We can design it so that the people who have died earlier are funding those who have lived longer. And so again, it's, they're now doing the flip side, but it's the same math idea of, if you live longer, you've collected out more. If you've died sooner, you've got that guarantee and that protection, but you paid more into the insurance company than you got out. So they're transferring the risk from the individual to the pool. So that's where annuities have come into play. The other thing I think you're referring to would be things like cash value life insurance. This would be whole life insurance or universal life insurance. There's both fixed versions that have fixed interest rates. There's also variable versions that will grow with the market or investments. And here, the math is likely going to be a negative expected value again as well. It is important to understand that when you are when you have a cash value life insurance that you've been saving into, the amount at risk to the insurance company goes down over time. And so if you have a $1 million cash value life insurance policy, at the beginning, there's no cash value. So the amount at risk to the insurance company is $1 million. As your cash value goes up inside that, then if you get up to $100,000, the death benefit's still $1 million. But if you die, they're giving you $100,000 of your own money and $900,000 of the insurance company's money. And as you build up this cash value, there's less and less at risk to the insurance company. But in general, the internal costs are pretty high. And that's one thing I do try to point out, that it takes a long time and the right circumstances for it to pay out. It is possible, but unlikely for most people. Either they need the cash value sooner, they don't get the returns that are illustrated, or the costs are just too high. But it is not inherently bad. It's just, it requires the right circumstance. The other scenario where it does come into play would be things like a second die policy, where this is now a permanent life insurance policy. So it is guaranteed to pay out. It's going to pay out, it's going to have one insurance policy on two lives. So it's going to be a long time. So it actually favors the insurance company. They can collect premiums for a longer time. And when they're paying out a large lump sum. This is usually done to protect against large assets, either for those who might be in a state tax situation. If their net worth is high enough, the estate tax bill can get relatively large. So this allows the heirs to pay the estate tax bill without having to sell assets. Or it might do something like pay off a mortgage if it is your desire that the children keep the house or something like that. It's a way to not have to force a sale of an illiquid asset by providing a large liquidity at the time that the asset gets transferred. That's the other scenario where I do see a life insurance policy making sense, even if it is kind of a negative expected value, that you're likely going to pay it in more over your lifetime than the insurance company will pay out, because they've done the math. They know you're going to die. We're going to make sure we collect enough money from everyone. It looks more like that annuity example where they'll make a little extra on the people who live longer and a little bit less on people who die sooner, but they can kind of use one to fund the other, and they're just collecting their profit margin, collecting their little vig in the middle. But that's an example where you're using the life insurance to provide a large liquidity that heirs may not normally have access to or be able to. So you see this with people who own several properties, that if they want to help provide liquid net worth or liquid assets without forcing the heirs to sell those properties, that's where you see this kind of policy come into play. But you're right. The math is, if the probability goes to one, then it is not a kind of leverage or protection. It's just prepaying. And that's where theoretically you could save up and cover yourself, but you have that negative expected value. You are paying the insurance company money so that you don't have to do it.
I think you made some very important points, and there are definitely nuances to consider if a client is digging down into these types of scenarios. And one thing I have noticed, for example, is it just at a high level in terms of something that I've recommended is, if you're young, I do think a term policy may make sense just because you're at a stage where you're building your wealth. But when you're in the later stages of your life, you may not need for example, $1 million policy because your net worth is already above $1 million, and so on. So it may make sense at that point to, again, self-insure rather than pulling in a whole policy that goes to the time that you die, because again, the probability of an individual dying is close to one. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I also have seen and also now caution clients against is there are variable policies where the premiums can start to creep up and actually get very high to keep the policy in effect once you start getting very old. Meaning if you have a survivor policy, like you mentioned, where the husband and wife both die, but in order to keep that policy alive, once the husband and wife start going into their 70s and 80s and 90s, those premiums can shoot up to be a very high amount, such that to the point where to keep that policy going, you may end up for a, you know, $2-3 million policy, have to put in $50,000-$70,000 a year just to keep it afloat, because the insurance company knows that that payout is getting more and more likely to happen once you get into old age. So from that standpoint, even though it may provide some tax benefits and some estate planning benefits, those types of policies can turn into effectively an expensive savings plan rather than something that's helping protect a situation where, for example, heirs may need liquidity, or a situation where some tax benefits may arise from having such a policy. So I think those types of scenarios need to be navigated with thought and care, because of course it comes down to the individual policy, but there's a few gotchas in there that clients may need to take into account.
That's a great message, because insurance and all the different types of products and policies available out there really do lie on a spectrum. That a term insurance policy for a family with young kids and a mortgage 100% makes sense. You need that. Disability insurance. If you are the primary income earner and something happens to your ability to earn income through an injury or illness, that is necessary. You need to have disability insurance either through your employer or your own policy. One of the things I like to add and point out is that the most common cause of a disability insurance claim is depression. It is not necessarily the car accident or you think you can't use your hands where, oh, even if I break my legs and I'm in a wheelchair, I can use my hands and type and I can talk and think. It is not that. It ends up being an illness that prevents you from working. That's why disability insurance, if you are earning income supporting family, is also very important. When you're older, the annuity, there are times that it can make sense. It's not quite on that 100%, but it's getting a little closer on this one step down the spectrum. There are benefits to having that guaranteed income for life that actually, even in terms of the way the math works, as a bond replacement can be really effective. It can make a lot of sense to use a single premium immediate annuity, that lifetime income stream, in place of bonds. That there are certain benefits there, the way the financial planning and the Monte Carlo simulations work out. The living benefit riders on variable annuities, they're in the gray area. There are some really good ones. There are some really expensive ones. And they also start... Also, it's where they start to get really, really complex. A lot of it is designed by the insurance company, the insurance agent selling it. You have to really understand these. They're easier to sell because people hear that guaranteed income or guaranteed asset growth, which is only kind of true. And you have to really understand the nuances and the technical definitions. That's in the middle. It can make a lot of sense for some people. It's very easy to be sold and also can be extremely expensive and not make sense if not done correctly. The car insurance liability, yes, there's a reason why a lot of states require you to have liability insurance. The collision coverage, yeah, maybe not. It maybe kind of depends on your situation, but has that negative expected value. Long-term care used to be the case where, yeah, the math really helps you out, helps cover that catastrophic event. Now that the odds of needing long-term care have gone up and premiums gone up, maybe not. And that's the idea with a lot of these insurance policies, that there are some that are necessary. There are others. I've seen a fixed annuity with a 20-year surrender schedule that you're going to get no growth and you can't get out of it for 20 years. And it was the worst thing possible. And these are both considered insurance policies. They're both considered insurance contracts. And there's no good blanket statement for all of them. It really is. Some are great, some are horrible. A lot of them are in the middle, in that gray area. And that's where it gets complex, and that's where it's really hard for people to figure that out. It's hard to find that person you can trust. Is, are they selling me one of the good ones or one of the bad ones?
Yeah, I think you make some very good points. At a high level, the guidance I like to make is, if you're looking for an insurance product, try to stick to the products that are bread and butter and simple, nothing too complicated. You don't need some fancy riders or some fancy coverage for things that are likely to happen. You can probably self-insure in those cases. So I'd say the first thing is try to shop around and try to come up with quotes from a few companies that are sensible. And also, I think it's worth doing annual or every couple of year checkups on your actual insurance products just to see if they're sensible for your needs, because those can change over time. And also that their prices are competitive, because all insurance prices can creep up sometimes for little reason and sometimes for substantiated reasons, but it's good to know.
I don't like to make that blanket statement, because I have seen there's a peace of mind effect. The fact that there is that, those guarantees do make people happier sometimes. I have seen that play out where, yes, they're happy to pay more. They're happy to have that negative expected value, and they understand the costs because there is a certain peace of mind that they're gaining in exchange for that. So it's not changing dollars for future dollars. It's exchanging dollars for peace of mind. And sometimes that is worth it to them.
Yeah, that certainly does make sense. So insurance for peace of mind, insurance for low probability events that, mm-hmm, should they happen, would create incredible disruption. I think these cases make sense.
Yep. I want to wrap up there, because I think if I go any longer, it'll get way too complex, way too fast. I think if anyone had any questions regarding insurance, I'd love to go deeper in this or answer their individual questions, but that's a good high level intro to the math behind insurance.
Yeah, great. I enjoyed today's conversation as well. And I think it did provide a good introduction to this space, since there's a lot going on here. I think this high level discussion definitely set the right gears in place.
Sounds good. Well, thank you very much, Tricia. I appreciate your time.
Well, thanks, Aaron. I enjoyed it as well. And thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're enjoying these conversations, we encourage you to spread the word and also subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.